Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this special edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. It's a special edition because we're coming to you live from the podcast booth at NRF 2018 in the Javits Convention Center in this gorgeous Crystal Palace. Coming up on today's episode, we've got news from Walmart about a new partnership for lighting and the energy savings it's providing them. J. Crew is closing some stores, and we get clarity on which stores they're closing and updates on important macro figures that affect the retail industry. We'll be joined by Jack Kleinhans, the chief economist for NRF, later in the show as well. A quick reminder, please rate us on iTunes or wherever you tune in. We'd really appreciate it. Helps to improve visibility. Also, feel free to connect with us at Story Ideas on Twitter. Our handle is at Retail Podcast, or you can shoot us an email at retailpodcast@gmail.com. Be sure and check out our new Instagram page as well. Handle there, same as Twitter, at Retail Podcast. We'll post unique merchandising pictures as well as highlights from things like this very big show 2018. We lead off today with that J. Crew news, the once popular apparel retailer that reshaped fashion trendsetting in the early 2000s. They announced in November they would be closing 39 locations, but we didn't have clarity in terms of which. Now we have a better idea of what at least some of the locations are going to be in terms of which ones are closing their doors for good. Now, you rewind to a couple of weeks ago, Eliza Brooke of Racked mentioned J. Crew as one of her top five least successful retailers of 2017, citing overturns in fashion sentiment as a main area of weakness. And Leighton, you and I aren't qualified to give our assessment on fashion, but we can certainly look at the operations side of things, starting out with a brief history.
J. Crew was started out in 1983 under the banner Popular Merchandise Incorporated, but in 1989 became known as J. Crew Incorporated, which also was when they actually opened their first retail store. Prior to that, they were really big on the operations side of things, actually producing apparel for other retailers, but they have since taken on a lot of retail stores throughout the country, but like you alluded to, Trent, have come on hard times. They actually have roots dating back to 1947 as the clothing manufacturer business versus being a retailer. The company has been seeing ups and downs and was actually publicly traded for a period of time until 2011 when the company was taken private. Thereafter, a $3 billion leveraged buyout from TPG Capital and Leonard Green & Partners. The company has made additional statements in the recent past saying they may close as many as 50 locations in the 2018 calendar year as they look to enhance their online selection and better identify the right product mix that suits their core customer. Former chairman and CEO Mickey Drexler, who is also the famed Gap Incorporated chief who turned J. Crew around since his coming aboard in 2003, ended up admitting in several interviews in the summer of last year that he would have never expected the retail business to change so rapidly over the next few years. Drexler was talking about, of course, the emergence of e-commerce, which has made adapting to trends harder, as well as being able to keep high margins with a mature apparel company like J. Crew in terms of store locations. You see people like new, but also like unique merchandise, and when you have over 500 locations and malls across the country, perception does get changed over time about exactly what your brand stands for. Drexler went on to say in the interview with Wall Street Journal that he would have actually done things a lot differently with the retailer had he known and taken the online business segment a bit more seriously around a decade ago. Drexler ended up stepping down from the company in July after that interview, which marked around 14 years with the company. He effectively retired at 72 years of age. He does still, however, own a 10% stake in the company as of last year. He's been buying up a lot of valuable real estate in the Miami area, so he's certainly enjoying his time off.
Now let's talk about J. Crew's latest quarter, their third quarter. They saw total company revenue fall, but also J. Crew's specific revenues fell 12% to $430 million. J. Crew comparable sales also decreased a total of 12%, following a decrease of 9% in the third quarter of last year. These figures alone really show their lack of online sales, since brick-and-mortar comps and total company comps were essentially equivalent, online sales not moving the meter much. The company still has Madewell, which sells jeans and handbags, among other items for women. That subsidiary has also come on hard times in terms of declining sales. Through the first 9 months of the fiscal year, the company's operations clocked in an operating loss of over $126 million. And in April of last year, the company cut 250 jobs at their headquarters in New York City. A lot was made of that, major media outlets. The company at one time had roughly 10,000 people working for them. They closed a total of 50 stores in fiscal 2017, but also opened some as well. So there is a little bit of a balance there. Net loss of 38 brick-and-mortar locations. So they opened 12 new stores in the U.S. But now with consumer chase changing and sales sliding for several years straight, they are making those cuts in terms of store count. Again, we knew about this in November, but we get clarity on which stores they will be closing for this next calendar year. The company has been spending more money allocating more resources into selling online, which, of course, long-term means potentially fewer stores. And they've actually partnered with a competitor in Nordstrom to sell some of their more popular assortments online. This, combined with a new marketing approach, new creative director, that's going to look to reverse all those negative quarterly sales trends that we just outlined that's hampered the company somewhat. This week, we learned the news of those locations that will be closing in the next couple of weeks. And Leighton, I know as you were looking through the list, some took you by surprise. A lot are in very popular shopping districts, including one very big structure in Minnesota.
Absolutely. And this is something we've been talking about more and more, as in terms of real estate, commercial real estate. And this is really interesting because J. Crew is in, like I had said earlier, a number of mall locations around the United States, a lot of very popular shopping districts. And so when this news came out this week about where some of these locations would actually be closing, it took us by surprise. And when we had talked earlier about this, something that stood out is that these locations are still very popular, and some of these malls that they're exiting are actually newer. You think of malls, conventional malls, indoor malls, as being older, stagnant, but some of these malls were actually built in the 1990s. So to start off, we have J. Crew, which will be closing two of its two Twin Cities locations. And you see that the Mall of America and Southdale are going to be the stores affected. They'll be liquidating and they'll be closing on January 27th. For the locals still interested there in the shopping at J. Crew, stores in Rosedale and in St. Paul on Grand Avenue will remain open. Number two, the Mall of Georgia in Buford, Georgia will also be closing its J. Crew location. The mall is very modernized, built in 1999, in fact, and quite popular with over 200 tenants. It's actually kind of a mixed space because you have an indoor segment and an outdoor segment with a lot of nice fine dining restaurants. This is also very interesting as the state of Georgia itself has been doing quite well in terms of the population growth and local economy. You see commercial lease rates as a result have actually been said to be going up quite a bit there in that state, which could be a factor if you're looking at the bottom line for J. Crew. Trent had mentioned an operating loss, and certainly lease rates are something to take into consideration. That location will also be closing on January 27th, along with the other two that I had mentioned at the Mall of America and Southdale. And number three, this also took us by surprise, and it's actually going to be in the state that you're currently in, Trent, Destiny USA, a massive 27-year-old mall in Syracuse, New York, will lose its J. Crew by the end of the month. Again, this is interesting because the mall, built in 1990, a very large, popularized mall that's actually a mixed-use space. They have a lot of office space, but four stories of retail, like I mentioned, just a massive building there. And there's actually an online petition, believe it or not, to not have it closed, although only as of today, 101 people have signed it so far, and only 24 are actually from the Syracuse, New York area, according to that petition's website. No news yet on what other locations are going to be closing, but based on the closing of the Manhattan location that J. Crew had in December, the company is being transparent about looking at increasing rent costs versus the performance of these individual locations. So with upcoming lease renewals, we may get a clear picture of what stores are going to be targeted. And Trent, I know you have a lot of interesting takes on this J. Crew setup, and this is one of the companies that has been outlined by a number of analysts that are going to be really targeted in 2018, companies in the retail segment that are going to be hurting. And J. Crew is in an especially tough industry segment, although those analysts and media pundits will undoubtedly take time to put them in with other retailers that have announced 2018 brick and mortar closings.
In news stories, we've already seen them looped in with the likes of Sam's Club and Sears, Kmart, Macy's, who have all outlined plans to close a number of locations this year. But most of the legacy retailers that have released plans for more closings are doing so more as a normal business practice. Target, for instance, is closing only locations that are grossly underperforming or going to be shut down in exchange for a new, often larger store nearby. And that's something oftentimes media members miss out on. When Target closes one store, it's usually to move into more premier square footage and make good use of the former square footage as something where they can either rent that out or sell. Sam's Club has said they might have cannibalized some of their existing stores with that closure of 63 stores, the announced closure of 63 stores last week. But we've talked about that not necessarily being the case with the Sam's Club stores that are closing. They're closing all of their stores in Alaska. They're closing all of their stores in the Seattle area. They're closing all of their stores in Puerto Rico. And it certainly seems like something else is afoot there beyond just underperforming and cannibalization. So really, when you look at this group, it is just Sears and maybe Gap that are closing locations more with a sense of desperation. Not even Ascena Retail Group is closing locations with that type of sense of desperation. And while many retailers did file for bankruptcy over the last couple of years, the number rumored to be actually in financial trouble, significantly less in 2018, which is great news for everyone surrounding the retail industry. It's more of a correction now, and we think that that correction is probably concluded heading forward. Now, as for J. Crew, after these closings, it's really only going to make a fairly small dent in their operations. They'll still operate around 490 locations heading into the summer months of 2018. And if everything works out for them in terms of strategy, that could help to benefit the company as they look to engage in a more streamlined omni-channel approach. The company still acts much as a publicly traded entity, even though they are not, with plenty of financial information disclosed on a quarterly basis. So we're going to see exactly how fiscal 2018 goes and if their strategies with the stores that are still open will continue to meet their midterm goals. And we're back at the 2018 NRF podcast booth, and we're pleased to be joined as part of a partnership with NRF by Tina Sharkey, the CEO of Brandless. And you are a featured speaker here at the conference. You've done so many things in your illustrious career, but I'd like to talk to you today about Brandless, if we could. If we could just focus on that one thing that you're involved in out of many things that you've been involved in over the past several years. As you were looking at the company and as you've generated the company now onto launch about 6 months ago, obviously you saw a need there. Where did you see white space in terms of what Brandless is fulfilling now?
So firstly, thank you, and it's great to be here. Honestly, what my co-founder Ido Leffler and I really saw as the opportunity for Brandless was at the very, very highest level, was to reimagine modern consumption. And I guess you can say something like that sitting at the NRF show, because that's what many people are trying to do here. And starting with the things that people reach for every day, but taking a different pass at that, thinking about the better for you filter, the lifestyle filter, the values filter, and simplifying everything and eliminating what we call the brand tax, which was the unnecessary markups you pay for national brands of similar quality, and really distilling it down to its simplest form. First and foremost, when you look at a supermarket, for example, the center of store, which is not, you know, where the perishables are, but where all of the staples are and all of the non-perishables, have on average 20 to 40,000 SKUs. We got it down to 250, so we simplified that. We also looked at the packaging. We wanted to have packaging and labeling that actually educated people as to what things were and rid them of false narrative, of unnecessary signals, and trying to figure out where you could find the values you're looking for, be it organic, be it gluten-free, be it sugar-free, be it no artificial colors or no animal testing, as an example. And then we wanted to reduce it down to a simple price point. So everything at Brandless is $3. Some are 2 for $3 and some are 3 for $3. So in a way, you almost don't have to bother checking prices. You don't have to bother benchmarking against other products. It just takes a lot of the complexity and the overconsumption and overproliferation of SKUs and products and messages and values down to a very simple form with what we call just what matters. Just what matters by category, so in beauty it's clean. Just what matters by food, all non-GMO, mostly organic. Just what matters by cleaning, all EPA Safer Choice certified. And everything that we sell at Brandless really is just what it says it is. So applesauce is applesauce, and multi-surface cleaner is multi-surface cleaner, and eliminating that false narrative so that people can live their own lives and tell their own stories.
There's a lot to unwrap here, but I want to go back to kind of your business model, direct-to-consumer approach, which is nice because you mentioned all the SKUs in a grocery store. Not only do you not have to try to stand out, but a lot of them, as you mentioned, are making maybe not false, but misleading value statements on their packaging. And this is a way to just...
inconsistent placement where you can't find it. It's not all in the same place.
And as someone who has... my wife has celiac disease, finding gluten-free labels on anything can be a terror in the supermarket.
Right. Brandless is for you because our gluten-free assortment is remarkable and it extends to our beauty and to our cleaning products and all of that, because if you are celiac, what's in your shampoo matters, what's in your conditioner matters, what's in your lip balm matters, what's in your tabletop cleaner matters, because it's kind of touching your skin. And so we're able to parse our entire site by gluten-free or by vegan or by no sugar added or by organics based on the lifestyle choices that you and your wife have chosen to use as filters for the way you shop and the way you live, and trying to make it easy for you and make all of that stuff accessible at prices that are affordable.
Now, do you feel as though the direct-to-consumer approach allows you to have a more transparent, a more clear dialogue with consumers without any outside signal interference there?
What's beautiful about direct-to-consumer is that, first and foremost, Brandless is a community. It's a community of people who all believe we all deserve better. And so by being in direct relationships with people and putting people first, we're able to build direct relationships. When we meet people like your wife and they ask us a question about our multi-surface cleaner and say, is that gluten-free? Well, we say, first of all, we hope you're not eating it. And second of all, let us understand what it means to be celiac so that we can actually curate and label all of the things that we hadn't initially thought of in our non-food assortment to be gluten-free. And let's curate that. So those relationships between our social team, our customer service team, our product development team, and most importantly, our community are direct. And we can be in that kind of conversation all the time. And we are.
Now, some people refer to you as a serial entrepreneur, but you have experience starting businesses. Let's lay that out. First 6 months at Brandless, what are some challenges? What are some successes that you guys have gone through?
I would say that, you know, the first success was that, you know, within the first 60 hours of our launch, we had already shipped to 48 states. And we only do ship right now to the continental U.S. So the idea that our message telegraphed and got out there and resonated with this audience, which is really at the intersection of belief and main streets, the idea that everyone in this country deserves better and better doesn't need to cost more, and you should be able to source by what you want, not what you can afford. People should be able to afford what they want for their families. And so the first overwhelming piece of feedback that to this day just sort of humbles us is how well received the message has been and how it's time for change in this country. And that doesn't have to come from Washington. That entrepreneurship, you call me a serial entrepreneur, I say that I'm a social entrepreneur. One, because I love building community, and two, because I like to build things, especially with my partner Ido, we like to build things that have the ability to really impact lives. But we're for profit, but we're also for purpose. And we believe those two things do not have to be mutually exclusive.
I've never been a fan of the term serial entrepreneur. It almost has this, I don't know, negative connotation. I like the term social entrepreneur a little bit better there. I want to ask you about, you mentioned the 48 states. Obviously, you have to build out a robust shipping platform to be able to fulfill to those states. And this is something that I think a lot of food retailers, especially in the e-commerce space, have had difficulty with, especially with something as simple as broken packaging. So how have you guys cleared that hurdle to make sure that the merchandise is getting to the consumer in its original intended form?
Look, I mean, I think that the most important thing is that we are listening and we are in direct partnership with our consumers. So if there's a problem, we're listening. We want the feedback. We're iterating on the packaging all the time. I think that people are cheering for us. And the most important thing is to be honest and authentic and transparent with the people that you serve. And so we are, anybody that writes us, calls us, tweets at us, posts for us, in any way, good, bad, or indifferent, like, we're a learning engine, and we are 6 months old. I said this morning, I was met a mom whose baby was 6 months old, and I said, what's your baby doing? And she said, not yet crawling. And I thought, oh my, if we were a baby, we'd be not yet crawling. But from day one, we've been shipping to 48 states, and we're aiming to get better every day and continually the feedback loop and not be afraid to change best practices or to adjust things for different weather patterns, et cetera, et cetera. The key is staying nimble and staying in direct connection with the community that you serve.
As we close out, because I know we're on a little bit of a time crunch here, one of the things that impresses me most about Brandless is the way you cultivate customer loyalty. And we've already talked about this a little bit. You look at your customer base more as a base that's rooting for you guys to succeed rather than, oh, hey, they're the customer, they're over there. They really are part of the organization. And one of the things I really like is this brand tax calculator. I was wondering if you could explain to our audience kind of how that brand tax calculator works.
Oh, thank you. So basically a brand tax is a name that we came up with to try and simplify the idea of it's the cost you pay for all the inefficiencies. So it's not just the brand marketing tax you pay for a national brand, but if you benchmark a brandless organic oil or a brandless clean shampoo or a brandless organic maple syrup, just as three random products, against a national brand of equal quality. So it has to be, if ours is organic, theirs has to be organic, et cetera, et cetera. And you look at the delta between their retail price and our retail price, on average, you're saving at brandless at a minimum 40 and sometimes as high as 350 to 400% from what you would pay for a national brand of similar quality. Now, is that because they spent money on national advertising? Maybe. Is that because there's distributor costs, there's markup costs, there's breakage costs, there's settlement fees, there's shelf stocking costs? There's like so many layers, especially in the naturals and organic space. The markup and the delta on premium pricing is even more egregious than it is in the mass market. And so what we're really trying to do in closing is democratize access to goodness, goodness in products, goodness in people, goodness in services, and goodness with the movement that we hope that our community will join us on in trying to spread and scale the work that we do every day.
In terms of markup, I think of it almost like the wine industry. Your markup is parabolic as the wine is classified as more premium. A little bit more of the markup there, and you guys are avoiding that. So, Tina Sharkey, CEO of Brandless, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. A pleasure.
Well, we have some retail sales updates from the month of December, as well as some good news on the inflation front if you're a consumer. We'll be joined later on the show by Jack Klein-Hines, the chief economist at the National Retail Federation, who will explain some of the December numbers as well as some macroeconomic factors affecting forecasts going forward. But first, we look at retail sales that were said to be up over the last year, which is not surprising given the strong holiday comps that many retailers and payment processing systems have been reporting. Most recently on this podcast, we've discussed the surging revenue at retailers such as JCPenney, Kohl's and Costco, but also niche retailers like Five Below and Dollar Tree. They've all been winning out from the sales through November and December time periods. And you see that though retailers have spent a whole lot on marketing, something that Kohl's specifically admitted in their latest statements, it has looked to pay off as people are spending more as they have slightly more discretionary income from full employment here in the United States, and wages are slowly creeping up year over year. On Friday of last week, the Commerce Department released their retail sales report, giving more good news to an industry that has witnessed a recent surge. Costco, Walmart, and other publicly traded retailers are all at all-time highs in terms of stock market valuation. And we see that the Commerce Department reported a fourth straight month of positive retail sales. We see that percent increase over December of 2016, looking back a year or so ago, was the largest positive comparative gap in three full years. December retail sales was a measure of consumer spending at brick-and-mortar stores, restaurants, and e-commerce transactions. In total, they rose a healthy 4.2%. And if we break apart some of the figures, we see that e-commerce sales in particular grew sequentially and by double digits versus December of last year, around 11% over last year's sales. In fact, this is interesting because we have seen figures that suggest many, including likes of Target, see 20% or more increases in their e-commerce segments. Even Bed Bath Beyond was in positive double digits here recently in their quarter, and we know that Amazon has seen significant increases there. So are we to wonder if pure play e-commerce retailers are growing at a potentially slower rate? There was a massive 5.5% increase in sales if you include automobiles and fuel expenditures. Fuel, of course, was between 5 and 10% higher than last year, depending on which part of the country you live in. Also, higher consumption as people are traveling a little bit more, shopping, going out for the holidays, but pricing still makes up the majority of the bump here with that increase. This means that not only are companies flourishing, but the industry as a whole is growing at a faster pace than inflation. Inflation was said to have increased sequentially by only 0.1% for December, which is a good thing if you're a consumer, and 2.11% annually in 2017. Pretty good numbers there, Trent. But if you look at the industry overall, it seems as though a lot of the analyst statements here as of late are really being pushed back by the hard numbers here with this data.
That's right. The analyst statements that we've had that have been kind of bearish over the last 2 years have begun to be walked back. And we couldn't agree more with Mickey Chadhoff, Moody's. He's their vice president. He said, and I quote, "The dire predictions of the demise of retail are premature. Customers are still buying, but where they are buying and how they are buying is changing," end quote. And a lot of that being talked about here at NRF 2018. I had to step into a quieter area here to kind of allow myself to think because there are so many people here at this big show, a gorgeous conference. But he also mentioned that companies are seeking a seamless consumer experience, and that has been kind of the thing that everyone is talking about. How do you reach the consumer across multiple platforms? And that's one of the reasons why we guard against retailers closing their brick and mortar outlets, because again, that's just another platform that can provide them some use in terms of reaching customers, and the better ones have been doing just that. Now, strictly in terms of total holiday retail sales from November 1st to December 31st, they rose 5.5% over the same period in 2016. And Jack Kleinhans will talk about those numbers here in a second with the NRF. That's up to $691.9 billion. Speaking of recent inflation from December, that tiny tick up may be indicative of more of the same in terms of 2018 CPI performance. From 2.07% in 2016 to 2.11% in 2017, the CPI is a measure of how much higher average consumer prices are year over year. The Fed has tried to enact policies to spur inflation despite the current rate being at their target of 2%. Reason for the lower consumer prices in December is not just a function of greater competition in the retail industry, which is something we've talked about on the regular, but also lower producer prices as well as commodity costs continue to decline in certain areas. The Labor Department said Thursday, in fact, that wholesale prices, which measure the cost of goods before they reach the consumer, fell 0.1%. In December, in fact, energy prices were flat, food costs still sinking. So not inflation, slight deflation in this latest couple of quarters, 0.7% food costs fell. And again, those are input costs, those are wholesale costs. Wholesale gas fell 3.9%, and gas prices at the pump fell 2.7% in December. You look at an area that's seen prices fall the most, it's towards meat, Leighton. Beef and veal prices down 6.3% over the same period in time last year. That's the most since July beef and veal prices have fallen. Meanwhile, prices for transportation and warehousing services also fell 4%, which caused lower shipping costs, ever so important, especially for those companies that rely on not just ship to store, but also ship to home as part of their omnichannel approach. And a lot of those retailers are picking up the tab on shipping. So lower warehousing and shipping costs, a big positive mark on those companies' bottom lines. FedEx and UPS have been doing quite well on volume, despite the fact that their rates have been getting squeezed through competition. And it was mentioned, of course, by none other than the President of the United States that the U.S. Postal Service rates were a little bit lower than he thought they should be. Unemployment currently, to kind of cap off these national numbers, around 4.1%. By traditional standards, that is very low, and it means a lot of discretionary income floating around.
I'm going to look at some of the main takeaways that both Trent and I sort of extrapolated from all of this big macro data. But first, I want to look on a point that Trent had mentioned about the transportation and warehousing services having fallen during the month of December. I think it's quite interesting because a lot of real estate analysts in the commercial sector are seeing that industrial space is becoming a very highly competitive arena. A lot more builds, a lot more new builds, but also a lot more demand for warehouse space because a lot are sort of seeing the future turning towards e-commerce. So they're going to need that space as fulfillment centers, distribution hubs, that sort of thing. So I think it's going to be interesting, that dynamic between supply and demand. While you have increased supply a little bit, the demand is actually outpacing that. So it's a little interesting to me that those services, or at least those fees, fell a little bit for that month of December. I look to see that sort of be neutral in 2018. I'm curious to see how that pans out. But as far as those main takeaways from both the Commerce Department and those Labor Department statistics, if you're an average consumer in America right now making a median wage, you're really most likely enjoying the immediate benefits from the lower relative prices of all the goods that Trent mentioned. Also, in terms of wage rates, early forecasts are calling for additional annualized increases of 3.2% in 2018. So again, wages are going up. That's another good thing if you're a person in the United States. Retailers like Walmart, but also many in the food service industry that we had once talked about on the Food Focus podcast, have been adjusting upwards as states and cities have been looking to increase their minimum wages. The federal minimum wage, of course, still sits at $7.25 an hour, but Walmart is looking to increase theirs to $11 an hour, which was Trent's Looking Ahead story on the last Retail Focus, while companies like Costco have already realized $13 to $13.50 an hour, depending on which state you live in. So again, a lot of this is a PR stunt because Walmart's minimum wage was already around $10.50. They were most likely looking to increase that anyway, but now they're saying that because of their tax benefits, they're looking to increase that minimum bump. But in 2017, wages were up 3.1% as more and more people were looking for work in the market for entry to mid-level jobs. And you see that market is tightening. And if you look back to 2016, wages increased around 3%. This means that while wage growth has been consistently above inflation for the past few years, it is also growing sequentially, as you see here, through the 2018 projections of 3.2%, which is a healthy market indicator. Those increased wages should actually be able to buy more items in terms of groceries and common consumer goods that you get at all of the retailers we talk about on this podcast, which will allow some to increase their personal savings rate. It is interesting because we are already going to be reporting about some of these very important statistics through the holiday months, in particular December, but a study that I came across here recently showed that the majority of adults related their increased personal savings to overall levels of higher happiness, or at least perceived happiness. Perhaps people will be in a better mood in 2018, and maybe because of that better mood, they'll be able to listen to more retail-centric podcasts like ours.
One can only hope, Leighton, that that's the case. And while we have the chance, I want to talk to you about the Internet Retailer Conference and Exhibition, which is your one-stop shop for all of your e-retail needs. This conference and trade show offers you everything your business needs to stay ahead of your competition in one simple location. Spend some time to learn, discover, and network. IRCE 2018 will take place in the world-class city of Chicago, June 5th through the 8th at McCormick Place West.
IRCE offers two full conference days with various tracks with pre- and post-conference workshops discussing all the new industry trends. Their exhibit hall at IRCE features over 600 top solution and technology vendors ready to help your business succeed in every facet. The hall covers over 250,000 square feet of space. That's over 28 Dollar Trees worth, making it the largest e-commerce trade show in the industry, ensuring you'll find the solutions you'll need.
48 Dollar Trees, that's a number that pales in comparison to other numbers surrounding this conference. 10,000 attendees, over 600 solution providers, and over 130 conference sessions featuring more than 200 speakers. Alan Cohen of Houses, the first main stage speaker announced for 2018. Go to IRCE.com and click Register to Attend under the Attendees tab and enter promo code RETAIL18. That's RETAIL18 for 10% off conference passes. IRCE.com, enter promo code RETAIL18.
Welcome to the area they call the Crystal Palace inside the Javits Convention Center at NRF 2018. We're live inside the podcast studio and right now joined by the chief economist of the NRF, Jack Kleinhens. First of all, Jack, I want to tell you it's an absolute pleasure to meet with you today. We are avid consumers of everything NRF, and so this is a fantastic pleasure. But I know coming into this, there's a lot to consume here at the conference. What stands out to you through the first day and a half?
Well, Trent, it's a pleasure to be with you today. Thanks for inviting me to join you on your show. There's so much here, it's hard to just narrow it down. But if I had to pick one activity, it certainly was the Innovation Lab. What we have in the Innovation Lab is sort of the current and near-term technology that's being developed for retailers, and not only from the retailer standpoint, but from the consumer also. There's also a section that's sort of futuristic, and it's fascinating on what people are thinking, how we might behave in terms of our shopping activities. And so some of the stuff, as the one curator was showing us, will maybe make it to the market and some will not, but it's, you got to build off of new ideas, and that's exactly what's up there, and it's bigger and better than we've seen in the last few years.
Very interesting to see the potential future. Well, I want to talk a little bit about your projections of the potential future here. Now, we'll talk about holiday sales here in a second, but first, before we go into that, something you and I were talking about before coming on for the podcast, it's not an easy process to attempt to forecast things. And when you look at a longitudinal map of where the NRF has been versus where reality has ended up, both of those lines very closely intertwined. So I wanted to ask you basically on behalf of our listeners, how does the NRF, how do you come up with these numbers that end up being so close to reality in most cases?
It takes certainly some experience in modeling, but knowledge of the industry. You know, data is secular in it by itself. I mean, it tells you information, but you need to know why you have that information in front of you and then what elements grow together, what's not. And so when we did this modeling several years ago, we went hours and hours through looking at certain trend data and history. And the data goes back all the way to 1992. So that's the first point where we had what we call the retail sales data from the census, which is great because you really would like to have a long set of observations, many, many years. And to have that in some industries, they're just it's not available. But long and short of it, you know, we tested, designed the model. There are a few variables that are very important. There is no proprietary information here. I mean, the model itself is, but I mean, it's been shown that a couple of variables are very, very important in terms of retail sales, and that would be disposable personal income. It correlates very highly with retail spending, certainly outstanding credit. And then you could add some other variables that are going to add to the forecast. But, you know, in terms of the most predictive one, I would say we would look at disposable personal income. And then the model itself, it's unique because I'm going to get a little nerdy. It's kind of a autoregressive moving average model. And what that means is in some cases we're looking at data over time. Boy, we are getting nerdy.
It's fine. It's my pleasure.
Okay. And we're looking at the moving average of the data, not the exact observation. And then in some cases, we call it autoregressive. And it's looking at the relationship of the data to itself and also what we call the residual. The residuals can also be correlated. So it's a dynamic system that we've developed. And as I was mentioning to you beforehand, we have a different model that we do for holiday spending, which is more of a monthly model, but we also have an annual model, which is a quarterly-based model. And just so you know, we'll be looking at early February for our release of our annual forecast for 2018.
Now, I'm not the smartest person when it comes to this stuff, but and correct me if I'm wrong, the use of moving averages helps to kind of weed out anything that's like three standard deviations beyond the mean and that type of thing.
Well, data tends to be volatile. I mean, we could just take a look at this year. If we take a look at consumer spending this year, there was a lot of ups and downs. In fact, the personal consumption expenditures, which is the big component of GDP, it grew 1.9% in the first quarter, then 3.3% in the second quarter, and then in the third quarter went down to 2.3%. So that's a lot of movement when it comes to consumer spending. And in fact, that was part of a little bit of a concern I had when I was thinking about the holiday and how we would perform. So, you know, you have to be able to understand how these data can move. And one of the other things that we look at as econometricians is the data stable? Because you can have this volatility, but is it volatile around a stable mean, if you will, or is there some kind of a acceleration or deceleration in the data? And if you don't capture that, you're going to end up forecasting probably a decelerating or accelerating level of growth much faster than it might actually be.
So let's turn back the clock to this year's holiday season. And we know now how robust it is. We're getting all these public sector companies that are giving us same-store sales updates. Most of their same-store sales are up. Their e-commerce sales are up. Can you talk a little bit to why we saw such a robust holiday season?
It was very impressive. I mean, there's no doubt it was vibrant. It was a performance that was exceeded our forecast. The number that we calculated was 5.5% on a year-over-year basis. Now, for your listeners, we ought to tell them that we exclude motor vehicle auto sales, we exclude gasoline, and we also exclude food services or restaurants. So we're looking at those as core areas throughout the year and during the holiday season. And in fact, there was a confluence of forces that were together. You know, talking about data and these variables, well, let me just go through about five of them that were much better in terms of their performance than what most people expected. First of all, there was a pickup in income. Disposable personal income for October, November was up 3.5%, which was a pickup from previously in the year. We saw home value prices up considerably, in excess of 6% on the national average, if I'm thinking. The stock market was up. I think I computed between October 1st and November 30th, we might have had like a 4% gain or 5% gain just in that small period. So that gave people confidence that their net worth, their value that they could draw on is much higher. And we can't minimize the importance of strong job growth. We had the job machine that really took off in October and November, albeit it fell off in December. But in September and October, we were clocking 230,000 new jobs per month. So that's new jobs, new income, new spending. So it couldn't have come at a better time. So those are key variables. The other couple of things that I point to is that consumers decided to borrow money more. Their credit card usage based on outstanding credit was up on a 6.6%. If I have to correct myself, let's just say at least 6% on a year-over-year basis. That's strong spending capability. And on top of that, we saw people saving less. So, okay, we had people had the ability to spend based on their jobs, their wealth, their ability to borrow money and to save less. So all of those came together at this time, and it was the best holiday 2 months, because we ought to define ourselves, November and December. It was the best holiday season performance that we had seen in about a decade.
Basically since the Great Recession, if you will.
Yes. Yeah.
We take all of this information that we've got here from the end of 2017, and we look at 2018 now, in terms of your projections for 2018. We've also gotten some clarity as far as the tax bill is concerned.
There's clarity?
A little bit of clarity, at least. A little bit more than what we had in December.
Yeah, and that's right, because that really kind of muddled our thinking back in September, because we had these hurricanes, too.
Absolutely.
We didn't talk about that. The fact of the matter is that late September we had those hurricanes, and the data that we were looking at was distorted, and it wasn't really until 2 months later that things had cleaned up. And that's a real problem from a forecaster standpoint, because I didn't know how to predict what the impact of the hurricanes and or at that time the tax plan was still kind of in a volatile state. So it was a very interesting time in the last few months when you start thinking about how the economy was going to perform and how the holiday season was going to perform.
So we've got just that little bit more of clarity going into 2018. How do all of those factors plus the tax deal affect the forecast going forward?
Well, we're not ready to release our 2018 forecast. It won't be ready until the first week or so of February. But nonetheless, the momentum that we have from these factors that I've just outlined for you will certainly continue. These are fundamental factors that are very important. And so when we overlay certainly the new tax plan, it's clear that, you know, it'll influence spending, it'll increase the potential for people to spend, and it should be a plus to the consumer and the overall economy. Now, the question really in front of us is, how soon does it ramp up? And we've been hearing that the tax tables are just going to be developed and need to be put in place in February, so we probably won't see people's take-home pay, or I should say people shouldn't see their take-home pay jump until maybe that February period. And then it'll just take a gradual ramping up because we'll have both consumer spending probably accelerating. I'm not looking at a rocket ship, but it's going to accelerate. At the same time, then we're also going to see that business investment is going to start to pick up, and that business investment will also have an impact on the amount of spending and jobs and income, and then ultimately on retail sales in many ways. So another kind of confluence of forces coming together on top of the numbers that I just gave you, the figures I was reporting to you. So I think that when I look outward, I think this economy grows in general maybe 2.6 to 2.8 right now GDP on a year-over-year basis, which is up from probably a 2.2, 2.3 this year, which is, that's notable. That's a good acceleration, and we need it.
That's a significant bump when we're talking about GDP, especially because we're talking about everything there.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we have to certainly make note is that other parts of the country, other parts of the economy is actually doing better too. I mean, the industrial sector has picked up manufacturing and construction in the latter months of 2017. So we have another level of economic activity that's being overlaid on top of the consumer. So, you know, the business activity should pick up, and with the new tax plan, that should be a bump for spending. We should see some of the increase in after taxes go into back into the economy, invest in these firms and invest in their employees. So it should have a cumulative effect on the economy. That was the intent.
Now, I want to touch on something that you mentioned in terms of your projection going forward, which is business investment. You mentioned that there are signs that it's picking up in 2018. Where have we been in terms of business investment? Because I know just looking, and we only really look at retail companies overall, and retail companies have, it seems like, started to ramp up their investment a little bit, whereas in 2016 and 2017, we didn't see those same levels of business reinvestment.
Well, you know, let's talk about broadly speaking on business investment. We have to go back to 2014. The dollar got stronger. We lost a little bit of competitiveness internationally, world growth. We also had a fallout in the energy market. And so a lot of the business investment, capital investment that had been going on in sort of those few years before, you know, 2012, 2013, had been energy related. And then when the price of oil fell, there was a pullback on energy. That was a very important part. So actually, 2014, 2015, and a little bit into 2016, we saw, you know, a lack of capital expenditures by business. In the last two quarters, that would be the second and third quarter, and we're probably going to see it in the fourth quarter of 2017, it's expected that there has been an uplift in spending by business. So that investment capability actually creates a bit of a multiplier and, you know, generates more economic activity, not just for that sector, but it'll have the effect of creating more demand for retail.
We're talking today with Jack Kleinhentz. He's the chief economist for the NRF. We're here at NRF 2018 in the gorgeous Javits Center recording this very podcast. So I want to ask you something that I asked you before we came up to the podcast booth, and I think your answer was fairly fascinating. I asked you, because economists tend to have a pretty firm grasp on history, where retail is at right now in 2017 going into 2018, is there another comparable period of time in history for retail to what we're seeing right now?
Well, you know, I'm sure that we could go back and map out, you know, a period of time, a period of years. However, I don't believe we have in our history a period of time where there was significant competition as we see today. We have global competition because we have global trade. And, you know, we can source goods anywhere in the world and they are purchased here in the United States. And that has kept prices down for goods. In fact, there's been significant deflation for retail, and that's been a challenge. So we haven't had a period of really rising prices for some time, and that has certainly affected the marketplace. And let's also overlay technology. I mean, nobody imagined that we'd be using our cell phones to be buying goods and services, doing research on what we might want to buy, depositing our checks by taking a picture. So the amount of technology that's in retail today, and as we as consumers, it's just amazing. And I want to give credit to the retail industry for the holiday season, because they were very strategic in their promotions and the use and adoption of technology. And I think that was another factor in this last holiday season, is that there was a synchronization of companies using technology, using the internet, e-commerce, at the same time the consumer had the ability to take advantage of, whether it was emails or it was special advertisements and promotions that would have appeared on your cell phone. I mean, there was a variety of ways that we were being promoted and learn about discounts. So that's why I think it's a difficult comparison in history. I suppose it'd be interesting to go back and think about the advent of the TV and that period of time in the 50s, when the economy was growing and we just started to have the proliferation of TV and radio. Perhaps that could be a possibility, but I haven't done the research on it, but it's probably a reasonable comparison.
Yeah, right around that era, if memory recalls, we saw the growth of the big box stores as well.
You know, Kmart and certainly Sears was big, still big, very big, and you know, there was a lot of traditional merchants there. But it's just a fascinating world that we're in right now, and I can't expect that it's going to stay the same. And I think, like I said earlier in our program about the Innovation Lab, I'm kind of excited to see some of these developments.
Now, I want to circle back to that, because you mentioned that was the part that stood out to you the most during your time so far at NRF 2018. But you're also talking about technological advancements of retailers helping to kind of build into this positivity that we saw, especially during the holiday season in 2017. Overall at the show, outside of the Innovation Lab, do you get more of that same sense that retailers are ready and willing to go into new technological forays to make a difference?
Absolutely. I think when you go down on the floor, you're seeing a lot of technology. There's the Innovation Lab, which is a part of the exposition, but there are a lot of retailers here, vendors I should say, that are presenting some really up-to-date technologies from a retailer standpoint. And most of it is designed to create more efficiencies within the retailer's space, whether it be in store or even online. And so it used to be there would be vendors here that, you know, you would buy goods and order them up for the year, you know, at the show. So it's a completely different dynamic than it was in the past. So I wish that we would get more attention, especially in the media, on how much technology is behind the scenes as well as being used by everyday retailers. I think they would be exposed to a lot of information that they hadn't seen before.
I want to close with a question that's kind of non sequitur to what we've been talking about. And I want to look at what got you initially excited about researching not only the economy, but also the economy as it relates to retail. What excited you first about retail?
Well, it's a huge industry. And let's decompose this a bit, because the largest segment of the economy is the consumer. 70-some percent of the GDP is consumer-driven. So there is so much in consumer economics, and then specifically in retail. I mean, think of all the sectors that we have whether it's building and materials, electronics and appliances, clothing, accessories, sporting goods, non-store, online, all these various different sectors build into retail. And each of them are unique in itself. So in some ways, it's a big, giant jigsaw puzzle. And each of these pieces are changing from time to time. So I'm always trying to figure out what the top of the box is. And so that's, as an economist, you know, it's, we're kind of problem solvers and we try to figure out these things. And so retail with its breadth of activity is very fascinating. And bottom line, it's consumer behavior. It's behavior, and how can we as economists understand why they're doing things, and can we have some value in telling who our audiences are, what is yet to come, and hopefully we're doing a reasonable job.
Jack Kleinhans, Chief Economist with the National Retail Federation. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus Podcast.
It's my pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Walmart announces the results of an ongoing decade-long partnership with Current by GE, rolling out LED lights in their 6,000th location. We see the statements from the release, and they say that as part of an ongoing commitment to energy efficiency, Walmart has now installed more than 1.5 million LED fixtures across more than 6,000 stores, parking lots, distribution centers, and corporate offices in 10 total countries. With energy costs traditionally representing one of the company's largest operating expenses, the monumental energy initiative over the past decade has reduced lighting energy consumption and reduced costs by more than $100 million. Now let's go to the NRF 2018 Expo floor, where Trent has Charles Zimmerman, Walmart's former VP of Design and Construction, who helped to oversee all of this implementation.
We're back on the floor at NRF 2018, our interview series, Deconstructing Retail, and a big announcement at the booth that we're at today is Current announced specifics of some of the results of their partnership with Walmart. And joining us to talk about some of the aspects of the lighting partnership is Charles Zimmerman, formerly a VP at Walmart, retired there. And now you're going to speak on the intricacies of this project here for Current. Well, thank you for joining us here on the podcast today.
Thank you, Trent.
Well, first of all, this is an amazing project. It's a large, hugely, almost all-encompassing project. You're talking about 6,000 sites, not only in the U.S., but multiple different countries. What was the size and scope of this project as you were swapping out the former lights for this current system?
Well, you know, we didn't start with doing the entire store. This journey really started for us about a dozen years ago. First with signage, then with refrigerated cases, then parking lot lighting. But at that point, even after touching all those areas, it was still only about 5% of the total lighting energy in a store. It was the sales floor lighting, which was the big piece. And that's really what is driving most of these numbers you see in this announcement.
So sales floor lighting is one part of it, but we were talking before we came on about lighting in frozen goods, lighting in produce as well. And there are a number of different benefits you get from LED lighting. It's not just energy efficiency, correct?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people have been confused when they first have tried to do the ROI analysis on like freezer case lighting. They look at just the energy savings from lighting alone, and the numbers don't make sense. But the reality is the reduction in heat load in that cold case, the reduction in energy there is greater than the reduction in lighting energy. And then the fact that these lights will last the life of the case is another big component of that ROI.
So you don't have employees spending time on maintenance, which is a benefit. You don't have to cool down the freezer section even more. And I would guess the southern markets are pretty pleased with the reduction in heat.
Well, they all are. I mean, inside that case, you know, heat is heat. And when you reduce by 70% the lighting energy, you also reduce the heat load by 70%.
Now, one of the other aspects of this project is parking lots, too. And before we get to the holistic nature of the project, what challenges did those present compared to the in-store lighting?
You know, really the biggest one was probably the fact, and it was really the same challenge for everything, in that the U.S. utility rates are so low compared to the rest of the world. We would work with Current to develop these products in the U.S., but they just weren't quite ready for the U.S. marketplace. But fortunately, Walmart being a global retailer, parking lot, we actually did the island of Puerto Rico first, took many of our competitors with Current to see that installation. Then the next market in 2008, 2009 was Central America. We did all 350 of our stores that we had at the time with LED parking lot lighting. And as we did that, the evolution of that product just allowed the price point to come down to a point where market by market, we eventually got through all the chain. And it was actually the U.S. and Canada were the last two markets where it made sense.
But you mentioned some of these changes were going on 2008, 2009.
Oh, absolutely.
It sounds like Walmart was far ahead of the curve in terms of LED lighting because hardly anyone was talking about it at that point.
Well, we were, and we had to be because energy is typically, for any retailers, their number two operating expense. And unfortunately, a lot of them think it's a non-controllable expense. But we've proven it really isn't a non-controllable expense. In fact, the press release references a 12% energy reduction since 2010, but that is on the heels of some aggressive things we did from 2005 to 2010. So, I mean, the numbers are really off the charts.
One of the other interesting things about this system as a whole, and about LED lights in general, is it allows you to select the lighting you want for each condition. So produce lighting is going to look different from frozen foods lighting, is going to look different from parking lot lighting. Was that a major factor for you guys?
You know, for a discount retailer like Walmart, it was not a big factor. It's just one of the additional benefits. And Walmart and other retailers are taking advantage of that. I mean, the more upper end retailers, of course, have a whole suite of opportunities that they'll pursue versus a Walmart will pursue much fewer. But the controllability, the quality, the dependability, I mean, it just all makes sense.
So one of the benefits of this system is that they call Current a holistic system. Everything talks to other aspects of the system. It's very communicative, more so than the old fluorescent lighting system. How exactly, in terms of Walmart, did that implementation help?
Well, you know, one of the things we've always tried to do at Walmart, and we did it with fluorescent, we just had our hands tied to a certain degree how creative we could be. But the light levels in a Walmart store in the U.S. are not constant. Based on the amount of daylight, based time of day, based on various conditions, they'll be at different levels. And with fluorescent, we just had a much more limited range that we could deal with that versus LED, the sky's the limit.
As far as, and to kind of bring this full circle, as far as Walmart's pledge towards overall energy efficiency, this is a major, major component of it, certainly. But what were some of the other initiatives overall that you felt like the lighting system built into or helped you achieve?
Well, so when you look at a typical large Walmart supercenter, the energy is basically divided into thirds. A third is lighting, a third is HVAC, and a third is refrigeration. As we talked about before, the less heat we're putting in a refrigerated case allows us to install less mechanical equipment to run those refrigerated cases. The less heat we're applying to the sales floor allows us to put less HVAC equipment on the roof. So while we've pursued more efficient HVAC, more efficient refrigeration, the incumbent systems became more efficient just because of what we were doing with lighting.
I'm curious, was safety also a goal here? Because oftentimes LED lighting is credited with, you know, throwing more foot candles in places. You'll be able to see things that you wouldn't otherwise.
Oh, sure, especially in parking lot lighting. I mean, one of the biggest champions that we had at Walmart for our parking lot lighting was our loss prevention team, because primarily the vertical illumination. So you could look at before and after pictures, and even with the foot candles being the same, the vertical illumination was dramatically improved with LED.
Interesting stuff. Charles Zimmerman, former VP at Walmart, retired as of last year. Still busy, though. Still going strong here at NRF 2018. Thanks for joining us on the Retail Focus podcast.
Thank you, Trent.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the end of this Retail Focus podcast, a special edition where we kick off looking ahead. Each Leighton and I look ahead towards one story that'll have our eye over the next week, month, or even year, and we begin with Leighton.
So for my looking ahead, it's actually linked to a story that we did a few months ago when we announced that Amazon was looking for a second headquarters. Of course, they're in the Seattle area currently, but they've been looking around the United States and in other countries, in fact, for a second headquarters. This is an interesting story because a lot of cities, a lot of states want Amazon's headquarters or their second headquarters to come to their area. Reason being, it can spur local employment, really help the local economies, help the universities, etc. You have the trickle-down effect anytime you have tens of thousands or potentially tens of thousands of people visiting your city for the company's headquarters. But the list isn't really that short, as a lot of media outlets were claiming that this is a short list. There's actually 20 cities that Amazon has narrowed their search down to. And I'm going to list these cities because potentially, if you're a listener, you may be interested if you're in one of these areas of the country: Atlanta, Austin, Boston, Chicago, Columbus, Ohio, Dallas, Denver, Indianapolis, Los Angeles, Miami, Montgomery County in Maryland, Nashville, Newark, New York City, Northern Virginia, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Raleigh, Toronto, and Washington, D.C. So like I said, it's not necessarily a short list because there's 20 cities in total, one being in Canada. Toronto is often rumored, was actually rumored from the get-go to be a city in the running here. And this is interesting too, because a few weeks ago, there were some pretty strong rumors that San Diego was bullish in this running, but San Diego is not on this finalized list of cities. We do see some other cities that have been pretty bullish in the headlines as of late to be in the running for HQ2. Boston is one of them, and Chicago a second one. Boston, I've seen a lot of rumors about future development, perhaps surrounding a potential Amazon headquarters in the future. So if you're a real estate developer, obviously you also want this because you're trying to look ahead and hedge bets and trying to get as much money as you can, because if there's more people living in a particular city and shopping, and therefore all the rents are going to be going up, or at least the supply is going to be going down, causing rents to go up long term. So a lot of things surrounding this big move for Amazon. I'm curious as to how this will all play out. Amazon had made statements that they want basically equal amounts of employees working in both locations. So I don't know if that's going to mean necessarily a reduction in their current headquarters, or if long term there will in fact be equal parts to both headquarters. But I am curious to see how this pans out. There's no exact timeline for when they're going to decide, but this does help narrow this down, and this is sure to really stem a lot of competitiveness within these current cities now, with these 20 remaining cities left for HQ2.
And one of the interesting things, three of the 20 are in the Washington, D.C. metro area. So you'd have to think currently, just by the numbers, that area is the favorite at this point. My looking ahead story has to do with NRF 2018. I've heard a lot this week about number of trends preaching customer service and businesses going out of their way to explore options to track individual shoppers who may be undecided in their purchase or might be hedging towards one purchase or another. There are a number of tracking systems. Intel showed off one that are at this conference. And I think my biggest thing that I'm looking ahead towards is what happens to the shopper that wants to be left alone. Everything at this conference was geared towards not necessarily interfering with the shopper's day, but rather customer service personnel on the floor trying to be a value add to the shopper. But there are, believe it or not, a lot of shoppers that prefer to go into a grocery store, a general merchandise retailer, or other retailer, and just preferred to be left alone. And in fact, there was one survey that indicated that by 2020, over 60% of shoppers will wish to be left alone in a retail store with their cell phones, left to do their own research. So I'm anxious to see some of the store chains that are implementing these tactics, that are implementing these high interference tactics with the customers. Do they run the risk of running perhaps some customers off because they are too customer service oriented? Or will customers eventually come around to the idea that their every move, their every whim is being tracked by the retailer? Again, something I'll be looking at, but I honestly think that there's still a place in today's retail world for just leaving the customer alone when it's obvious they want to be left alone. And that's something that a lot of tracking software can't yet measure. That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. Check out our podcast coming up next week. We'll have a couple more interviews from NRF 2018. And as always, you can check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast or Instagram also at Retail Podcast. Have a great week.
This has been Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.